This is Xformation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today, as always, I'm joined by my colleague, Caden. I'm going to completely stop using your last name because you're okay. Just Caden, right?
Is Rosenbaum too hard?
Yeah. No, not at all. Yeah. I like it's obviously a good last name.
It sounds good, doesn't
it? We're going for something more colloquial here, Caden. Okay. Come on.
Yeah, well, I'm just Caden in my emails, so that's fine.
Exactly, right. And I'm just Will. I mean, I'm just trying to have a conversation here. So do you want to see my trophy?
Yes. Your trophy for what?
Look at this. Look at this thing.
You're a champion?
I'm a champion. What? I'm a champion of the kickball league. I won the kickball league. My team won the kickball league.
Yeah, that's congratulations.
Yeah, right? This was
balls well.
It was so in the middle of COVID, right? In the middle of COVID, I wanted something to like get out there. I just wanted to be a little more like active and have something to kind of run around and just do, right? So anyway, my friend, who is now since moving, she's starting her graduate program at University of North Carolina. So she pulled together.
Congrats to her.
Yeah, I know. She's very, very sharp. So she pulled together a kickball team and we've had two seasons, right? The first season, we lost half of the games. But our first game, first game that we played at the very, very beginning of this was the same team that we won this championship against.
Oh, way to make
that
a comeback,
team,
Will.
I know. The entire thing's a comeback story. It's a great story. I know.
What's your team name?
It's called Bigger Kick Energy. Yeah, BKE.
Bigger Kick Energy. Kick Bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
Wait.
You did kickball during COVID. I did VR table tennis.
Nice.
And I got to tell you, man, I'm really good at VR table tennis, right? Like I'm very good. At one point I was in the top 2000 in the world or whatever. And then more people joined because they got more VR headsets. And now I'm no longer very good at all, but I still think I'm pretty good. And today I woke up and it's my 27th birthday. And I woke up today.
Today's your birthday?
Yeah, today's my birthday.
How come I didn't know? Oh, it is. Today is your birthday. I thought that was Thursday.
I don't ever know what day it is. It just happens.
Today is definitely Wednesday, my friend.
So I woke up today and my back was just on fire, right? Like it was just sore. Pain was radiating throughout my body.
Yeah.
Felt like I had compressed my spine or something. Turns out once you pass the age of like 26 or so, you kind of have to stretch before you just start going wild on your VR table tennis for 2 hours. And
this is a real, you should not have admitted this on tape, my man.
Listen.
Come on now. You have to stretch for your table tennis game?
Yes.
Your VR table tennis game.
I get very involved. I jump around. I do these crazy arm motions to throw my opponents off. I mean, I'm really
invested. Is this the future of exercise?
I think it is. I really do think it is, right? It's a lot like Beat Saber, which the Mythbusters guy says is exercise because you're flailing your arms, you're doing all these movements. And if you put some weight into the controller, it really gets you going, or at least it gets me sweating, but it's just because it's hot and that little thing.
Yeah.
But I really do think it is. I spend maybe 2 hours a day and that keeps me in shape. It keeps my heart rate down, you know, throughout the day. All this stuff. And
I want evidence of this. I'm not convinced at all.
Just ask.
Send me the link to this. Send me the link to this. This Mythbusters. Is this a Mythbusters?
He turned his controller into a lightsaber, right? And he built a lightsaber made out of metal.
Yeah. Adam. I forget his last name.
Adam Savage.
There you go. Adam Savage. Yeah. So, Caden, we're talking about something completely different than either trophies or VR table tennis. Today we're going into the Amazon lawsuit, the one that just recently dropped. Tell me what's going on there. Tell me what the saga is. Cause I know there's an interesting.
Wait. Cause I want to say the name of this because I feel like I should trademark this. This is kind of my thing.
Do it. Yeah.
There's been some interesting developments in antitrust, right? And there is this 21st century antitrust saga that's happening. And the chapter that Amazon has entered into now happened on a sunny day in Washington, D.C. Residents were unmasking. HQ2 is going up. I live right next to it. and Jeff Bezos was planning for retirement, if you can call it retirement. And then the attorney general of DC came and rained on Amazon's parade, slapped him with an antitrust suit.
Yeah.
Right. And the suit isn't political, right? It's not like some of these others where it's about censoring conservative speech or, mainly just censoring conservative speech is what we've seen so far as the justification for bringing them. This one's different. It's actually involving markets and sellers and smaller companies and bigger companies, third-party sellers. And that's why I find it interesting, because it's also kind of political, right? It's about government.
It's like political
distrust.
And not political, right? It's like, it's not political, political in the way that we've seen political. It. Yeah. It's not political in the way that we've seen before, but it is, it's like a new front, right? It's a new front in the war.
Well, I want to say it's a new front in the war, but it's sort of like this older, more traditional political, right? Like antitrust developed out of politics, meaning Congress distrusted big corporations like Carnegie Steel. And so they passed the Sherman Act, and that was their way to keep, large corporations from overturning the government is what they thought. This one's kind of got the same feel to it. It's distrusting a large company not to take advantage of people, not to mislead consumers, and not to block out competition so that we only have one seller. And that's where it gets kind of political, because while the right is typically concerned with, or at least now is concerned with, conservative speech on the internet, the left is very much concerned with data privacy, big corporations. This falls into that umbrella.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
It gets really interesting. And then you jump into the meat of it and it gets even more interesting.
Yeah. So let's jump into the meat of the argument or the complaint rather from Racine. So, I mean, to be very, very clear, this is coming just from the DC, I guess, state AG, I guess.
So
is it a state AG? It's just an AG, right?
Oh man, I am not prepared for that question. I'm just going to call him DCAG.
DCAG.
We're going to sit with that one.
Rolls off.
Other people are going to have to Google that.
Yeah.
But no, and he brought it in DC court, and it's not under the Sherman Act or the Clayton Act like we've been seeing in the other antitrust cases. This is DC law, DC code, meaning, I don't know what that means yet. I think it's important. I flagged it because I think it's interesting. I don't know why it's interesting. I'm still new enough to law that things are still really interesting whenever they pop up that are new, but it's still, it's DC code. It's not the Sherman Act, not the Clayton Act. And that means that it's only going to be isolated to DC. It won't apply nationwide unless you bring a nationwide suit under federal law in federal district court.
Interesting. Yeah. So the,
is that
so
interesting? Very, very, I think it's,
yeah, no, it's just very narrow scope, right? I mean,
yeah.
We can talk about this a little bit later, but my expectation is something would get merged right at the federal level, that this case would be brought together with other cases that are against Amazon, right? Yeah. This would be like just one aspect
to federal
of the
district
case.
Court.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. That's kind of what the expectation, at least I think, that we should probably foresee in the next couple of years happening. That being said, let's go through the argument, right? So let's hit up some of the complaint items. I think probably the best way would be some of the weakest places first.
We're going to follow Jim Dunstan's solid advice to me once, where he said, start with your strongest argument. My strongest argument is DC's weakest argument. So let's just start with that one.
Yeah, okay? There we go.
And it is the platform most favored nation agreements.
Yeah, the MFNs.
And before I get into that, I'd really like for you to say what a most favored nation agreement is, because I always stumble over it first, but also this seems more like an economic thing. I'd really love to hear about it from you, and then we can talk about Amazon's policies.
So yeah, MFNs are, from my understanding, are just kind of this broad class of clauses that exist in contracts that effectively allow for, you know, whatever this, you know, it's in the case of Amazon, the Amazon platform seller, to maintain it such that they're given the same treatment as everyone else, right? So that there's no price differential between an Amazon product sold by somebody on Amazon and another platform. So it's usually just a way to ensure that you know, that you're getting the best deal, that you're getting the most favored deal that is being sold by that company. Which, I mean, it obviously, from my understanding, also these clauses, there's a whole bunch of different ways to actually determine what these clauses look like, right? So there's more than just like a pricing deal, but I've mainly understood them to be regarded within like the space of pricing.
So Amazon has what DC is alleging to be this MFN, this most favored nation agreement.
Yeah.
It's got platform before it. So PMFN, which sounds like MSI. And if you've ever studied for the bar, you know how terrible that word is to you. PMSI, whatever. So we're back to PMFN, which is Amazon's got this fair pricing policy, and it used to be a price parity policy, and DC is saying, and then that just effectively became the same thing as the fair pricing policy now, because it was pushed out from 2013 on. It was sort of pushed out from the EU to the US, and it was just gone. But effectively, DC alleges the fair pricing policy is there. What the fair pricing policy does is say that you can't charge a price on Amazon that's different from a price on another platform. So if I sell shoes and I sell those shoes for like $35 on Amazon, I can't also sell those shoes on eBay, for example, for $25, right? To drive customers that way. Because what that does, Amazon says, is it harms customer trust, meaning they see the seller selling it at one price on Amazon and then they see it on eBay and they're really not sure what's going on. They feel tricked. It's not a good customer experience. So Amazon has this FPP, fair pricing policy, which says, don't do that.
Yeah.
So that's the first little item that DC starts with. And I think it's the weakest because to me, while it looks like they can set the price of a product and then you can't compete with Amazon on another platform by setting lower prices, while it could look like that, it's more about the customer experience. And that's where I get lost on this argument from DC. I don't think it's as strong because it's all about getting more sales. And as a third-party seller, that's what you want. So I think that that's probably the weakest part. But then if you add more elements to this, it gets a little stronger and it gets a little more interesting.
So what are those other? Yeah. What's the other element that's interesting from the complaint then?
So to be a seller on Amazon, you have to pay a fee, like a seller's fee. And you can either pay a monthly $39.
Depending on whatever your contract is.
Or you can pay 99 cents per transaction. One of those two things.
Yeah.
And typically, if you're a seller and let's say you're paying for shipping, you would say, here's the price of the product, here's the price of shipping, and you would build that in the customer paid all. And that's how you would spread out the costs. If you're selling on Amazon, you do the same thing. You put the fees in the costs. And you cover it that way. That way you maintain your profit margins. But if you do it on Amazon and you build in that price, you also have to build it in elsewhere. Meaning if you're going to sell on eBay, you're factoring in the cost of being a seller on Amazon into the cost of your products. So that's where it starts to get interesting, right? You're talking about building in costs on another platform just to be on a totally separate one like Amazon.
So you know, wait a second, is this related to the FBA, the Fulfilled by Amazon, like that? Because I know that, I mean, I used to be a seller back in the day, right? I used to sell some stuff on Amazon. Yeah, I mean, you know, just sell like whatever I had extra clothes, like I would sell that kind of stuff on eBay Amazon, like books, right? Yeah. So is it related to those sorts of products, like the price differential between those sorts of products?
So it sort of is. Amazon charges... charges its third-party sellers for the fulfillment service, which is basically like send them the product and you're done.
This is the FBA stuff, the Fulfilled by Amazon. Like you ship it to them, they have it in like a big huge warehouse, and then they deal with everything and you just give them whatever. It's either like a certain fee or like a percentage on the overall transaction or something along those lines.
And you know what you don't have to pay for? Shipping to customers, logistics support. You don't have to sit customer there support, and like wait for a product to get bought by a customer, and then you have to go to the post office. There's an opportunity cost of your time. You just send it to them. You forget about it, and you market your product. That's all you focus
on. Yeah, no, totally.
And that's great. But
does DC not think that? Does DC not think that's great?
Yeah, yeah. So
that's
so
interesting.
DC is making this complaint that it's only the Amazon is only featuring products in their buy boxes or their featured product listings that have this fulfillment service. So let me just take this offline for a sec. Go to a grocery store. You're walking down an aisle and you're going down the cereal aisle. You don't really know what you want. You're just walking down it. And then you see Frosted Flakes right at eye level. That's product placement, right? Eye level is buy level. And you don't see the Corn Flakes or the Gorilla Munch or the off-brand sugar-coated flake things that have the store name.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
it's exactly the same thing. It's cheaper, but it's not Frosted Flakes, and you don't buy it because Frosted Flakes has the brand name that's right there at eye level.
It's on eye level, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you pay for that eye level placement. Kellogg's pays for that placement.
Yeah.
That's not what Amazon does, right? Amazon puts products in their featured product category if they know they can sell it, if they know they can ship it in 2 days. And the only way they know they can ship it in 2 days is if it's sitting in their warehouse because you're a fulfillment service person.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's how they do it. And that's kind of what DC takes issue with, which I kind of find hard to believe that that's their best argument, because the better argument, the one that I really thought that they would bring, is Amazon's products. Now, every grocery store has an off-brand.
Yeah.
Like Giant, Harris Teeter has Harris Teeter water bottles or whatever. Yeah. CVS has CVS medicines. Amazon has its own products. And theoretically, you could take out the fees that a seller pays and you just have the base cost of a product. And Amazon could take the base cost of the product, mark it up like a dollar, and out-compete everybody. Theoretically, it could do that, and it could push out third-party sellers. That's not the argument DC makes, though. That's the argument Jonathan Baker makes in Antitrust Paradigm when he proposes this hypothetical. And I thought it was really persuasive. I thought that was the real issue. But it wasn't the issue DC took issue with. It was the featured product thing and how you have to pay for the fulfillment service. Here's the thing about that, though. If you're working on getting a better customer base, you want to have two-day shipping. And you want to be able to ensure that you can ship out in 2 days. If sellers are shipping it themselves, there's really no guarantee you can make. Customers begin to get wary of your platform. They go somewhere else. It's not only bad for Amazon, it's bad for the third-party seller because they have less sales. That's how I get tied up in this argument. And I don't really understand why that's part of the complaint. Because that sounds like it's more efficient. And I don't mean efficient like the pseudo-economic arguments some of my legal colleagues make. Efficient like you can make sure that your customers are getting the product reliably on time. You can make sure that logistics are great using economies of scale. It's better. And it helps third-party sellers sell more products.
Yeah. No, totally, totally. There is this idea, I always forget the name of it. It's like behavioral theory of the firm. Where I think that's the name of it, behavioral theory of the firm, where it's that people specialize in certain kinds of behaviors, right? That you have a company that say that researches and does nothing but R&D, while you have another company that is very, very good about networking or selling sorts of products. And so that the merging of the two together is beneficial because you get the people who have dedicated themselves to research get their work applied to a seller, you know, platform, wherever it may be. And such similarly, the idea is that exporting those things, right, that exporting other sorts of cognitive functions that you don't want to have to deal with, particularly shipping and logistics, which are a pain, by outsourcing that kind of work, you're actually making yourself more efficient on the retail side. So that's really, really interesting to me. That's a really interesting sort of problem that they're pointing out. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, because I was going to wrap this up.
Yeah. So no, I was going to say with the products question, at some point I'd like to do a bigger, longer dive into the products question when it comes to not just Amazon, but there's like Amazon, and this is also happening.
Walmart Google, got in trouble for this too, right?
Walmart. Yeah. A whole bunch of it. This idea of taking. Yeah. So the Wall Street Journal, I can find this and we'll do another deeper dive on this. There's this really, really interesting kind of endemic problem, which is not endemic problem. I shouldn't say that. It's a potential problem. I'm really skeptical of it, primarily because at least most of the reporting I've seen has shown that Amazon's prices are higher for those things that they steal. So that data is actually a little bit more wonky. But I do know there's some other research out there that I would love to pull together for another future conversation.
Let me wrap this up. Let me boil it down.
Yeah, please do.
Let me give you the long and short of it. Aaron Sorkin, I apologize if you're listening. Probably not. So I've got 3 points. First, Amazon limits the price gouging that sellers can do between platforms by using their fair pricing policy. And that ought to be seen in a favorable light, not a negative one. Second, I lean on the side of Baker about this hypothetical product problem. But I'm really not buying the argument that Amazon harms third-party sellers more than it helps. It helps a lot. And then finally, selling products online, it costs something. Just because it's online doesn't mean you can just transport it immediately, right? You still have to walk down to the post office. You still have to wrap it. You still have to ship it. And you still have to make sure it got to where it was going and monitor customer relations, all of that nonsense.
Yeah.
All Amazon does is streamline that for you so that if you're a third-party seller, you can sell more products, your customers are happier.
Yeah.
I don't see the issue. It's just a better service agreement between third-party sellers, and they're just managing that agreement, that relationship. So while this complaint has some interesting issues, the politics of it coming from the other side this time still kind of shine through and make the arguments less strong.
So what you're saying is the perfect complaint has yet to be filed.
The perfect complaint has yet to be filed.
I think on that note, we are done here. It's a shorter one, but hey, you know, we're just trying to crank these out. So,
Mike, we're done here.
Nice. Caden, thanks as always for joining me. And with that, we will see you next week.